back to another episode of ABA Mom. I'm your host, Allie, a board-certified behavior analyst and mom of five. And today we have a very special guest. It's Chris Sabo with Connect and Care. And today we're going to be talking about the importance of NET and ABA. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, of course. Chris, can you just share a little bit about your background and your current job and what all of that looks like?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So my name's Chris. I'm BCBA as well. I've been in the field about 13 or 14 years. I've been doing it more or less my entire adult life. And I've been kind of in every position, really. I started as a technician, as an RBT, worked in various locations and settings, clinic, home, residential, school, community. And I've focused a lot of my professional career in the home setting. It's just been a good fit for my philosophy in terms of generalization and making impact in the way that I feel is most useful. But I really do see the value in a lot of settings. And I'm not someone who's like anti-clinic or anti-anything, really. It's been a good fit for me. A little bit about my role at this company. I serve as director of clinical training, and I really, I started this role kind of hoping to be an advocate and support for RBTs who often feel under-supported in their, I'm really passionate about enriching their experience. So I host monthly trainings and really deliver content that's practical and useful for them in their clinical everyday practice. I also supervise and mentor students. In addition to that, I work on mentoring new BCBAs, first-year BCBAs and BCABAs, and establishing a strong foundation for them. And a lot of what I do in that is to try to, not challenge, but expand their existing clinical training and to think a little bit more deeply and critically about their programming. So yeah, it's a little bit about my role and things like that. I am, of course, on this podcast to talk about naturalistic interventions, and it's a topic I'm very passionate about. It's probably the thing I'm most passionate about in ABA.
That's awesome. Yeah, and what you do is so important, too. It's so important to have a trainer, especially for those new BCBAs that kind of come to the field and are like, what am I doing? So I think your role at your company is very important to be a trainer. You know, even BCBAs, RBTs need trainers, certainly, but BCBAs need trainers as well. So I think what you're doing is very important. And so we're going to dive into it. So you're really passionate about naturalistic training. So why is it important to incorporate natural context into our teaching goals? And how does this benefit the learner?
I think that's a really important question. And I think the answer in that question is really evident in everyday life for all of us. And I think naturalistic teaching is analogous to play, because it's play is our interests, right, on the front line. And I think a desire for play is not something that we outgrow, nor are the things that play teaches. I think it takes on different forms as we get older, but it's really, truly fundamental to the human experience. And developmental research over the last two decades has shown us that developmental milestones are interrelated. So rather than assessing language skills, motor skills, social-emotional skills separately, I think we should look at how well these abilities are integrated. And they are best integrated when we're engaged in play. And so as you reflect on your own life, especially if you've had kids, I know you do, and you've been around kids, as we all have in our field, you know that learning happens through play, right? And in addition to that, and this is really important, play is paired with having an emotionally charged experience and a connection with the experience and the people involved in it. And the value of having an emotionally charged experience when you're learning really can't be understated. It's really at the center of how children begin to understand the world. And in fact, language and cognition, as well as emotional and social skills, are truly learned through relationships that involve emotionally meaningful experiences. And I think that in ABA, we really do understand the importance of that. We spend a lot of time developing a strong emotional attachment with our clients and having a reinforcing reciprocal relationship with them. But I think how we use that relationship, and I know we talked about this, you and I, before, how we use that relationship sometimes is not fully realized in our sessions. I think we're really good at using that relationship for instructional control and establishing contingent access to that relationship. But sometimes I feel like its value is not really extended beyond that. So to go back to play, if a child is not showing interest in something, naturally when we're engaged with them in play, we pivot. We make a response that's different. We try to figure out how they're going to be more engaged in play, right? And our programs in ABA are not always flexible in that way. And in there, I think there's strength, right? It ensures high fidelity and clarity and is measurable, right? But it also, I feel like, contradicts the very essence of play, which is spontaneous and requires that interaction to inform how we're going to learn together, you know? And I think the biggest question I that people have when I say these things is, how do I program around that? How do I train other people who aren't as skilled or as trained or as knowledgeable as we are in how to provide structure and know what to do next in that spontaneous interaction, right? And I think my main goal here today is to answer that question and then ideally inspire other people to think about that and answer that question for themselves too.
Yeah, and I do want to just say as a practitioner that the discrete trial training is easier for me. Like, that's easier because it's structured, okay, like this is what we're going to do next and knowing the next thing. Play is, there's a lot of unknown, right? So when we're working with kids and we're doing play, like we kind of, when it's client led, we just don't even know what's going to kind of come next, right? So like it's led by them. So I think sometimes as practitioners, that can be a little scary for us, but I think it's better for our learners. Like it's better for the clients to have that and being able to play, because you're right, with learning happens during play. There's a lot of learning that happens during play. So I love that. But can you provide some specific examples of how you follow client-led activities?
Sure. Yeah. So I think we all have some really good examples of that when we're in the pairing phase, right? We know that in that phase, our goal is to facilitate purposeful emotional interactions with the client, right? You're going for that, the glean in the child's eye where they know that you're engaged and you're really having that meaningful interaction, right? And I think what we're doing, if you could digest that, is that what we're doing is we're treating all of the child's behavior as purposeful. And then we're doing something with that behavior to make an interaction meaningful, right? And so if I take a typical example, a child who's flapping their arms, right? You could take that at face value and do nothing with it, or you can make that the foundation for doing some kind of interactive flapping game or something like that, where you're building on their interests, but you're also engaging and hopefully building on some pivotal skills like joint attention, regulation, sustained engagement, right, through that. Looking at more advanced types of interaction and client-led activities is also important. I want to open the scope here. I really enjoy working on social problem-solving skills and social-emotional thinking through imaginative play. And the imaginative play is based off the child's interest. So say it's just outer space, right? We might go, and the program might be designed in learning in Center Reach as we'll solve a spontaneous problem that happens in an imaginary play scheme. So for example, we're in outer space with the client and all of a sudden we run out of gas and the client needs to solve the problem, right? We need to figure out a way for them to initiate some kind of strategy or some way to get out of the situation, right? And so we're engaging in logical thinking there. We're pushing the boundaries of their understanding of language and executive functioning. So you might run like a how question. How are we going to get back home? Or a why question. Why did this happen? You're still doing the same things, but you're also engaging more flexible thought and not as rigid responses. And of course, it's client-led and you've got all the buy-in in the world in that situation. You know, so I think this is how you create real skills, how you enable a child to create ideas and not just memorize. They're integrating all their skills, like I was saying before, into one situation that's super functional for them. I think those are some good examples I have. And I think that's how we can begin to shift our mindset towards thinking in the gray, right? ASD deficits are typified by inability to understand nuance, right? To think in the gray area. What our programs are often designed to do is to have a concrete response to something. But I think that contradicts some of the deficits that we're trying to work on, which is an inability to understand nuance, to think more flexibly, to generate new ideas, right? So.
No, I love that example. And I love that you're doing the same thing. So you're still creating those questions, so the WH questions, but then you're just doing it in their play, like in their mind, in their imaginative play. So I love that you're taking it out. It's really kind of outside the box thinking. Because, you know, I think as adults, we kind of also have just become very, okay, like this is the way things are run. Like we become very categorized in things. Having like a child lead, like I said, that can be a little scary just because of the unknown facts. It's like, okay, so where am I going to put these WH questions? But the idea that just kind of let it happen, let it flow. And then you're also teaching them that flexibility in those situations. And I like how you defined it as the gray area. So that's very important. So I think it's a great thought process.
I think it just comes back to how we're writing the and modeling, writing the programs and modeling them, right? If we write it in such a way where we've structured it enough where we tell them, okay, you're going to set up an imaginary situation based off of whatever they want to do. And you're going to think of ways, and you're going to model this, of course, of how to create a problem that happens, right? And then that's your prompt. That is the SD for you to initiate some kind of WH-based question, right? But again, it embeds symbolic thinking, which again is core to addressing some of the core deficits of ASD. It's right. A pivotal behavior for them.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. But how can parents and caregivers be involved in development and implementation of natural teaching goals at home?
I think the best way to do that is to, this comes back to pivotal response training. And one of the things that PRT talks about is responsivity to multiple cues, which means that a client can respond to something in more than one way. And this comes back to symbolic thinking, of course. But think about a toy that has multiple features, and having that be the foundation or learning tool for caregivers to start to do and run many of the programs we run within a single toy. So think about a toy conceptually, really dig into it, right? Whether it's Mr. Potato Head or a shape sorter that has all different features, or Legos even, Play-Doh, you can do so many things with those things, right? And when you have a strong model that's based off of one thing, I think it's much more digestible for caregivers. So really deep dive into a specific toy and have that be the foundation under which you're teaching some of these really important skills for them, and then build out from there. That's my best advice for that.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And, you know, every parent kind of knows, like, they know their kid, like, know what toy specifically, like, they always play, whether that's Mr. Potato Head or, you know, like, they like Fortnite and they have, like, a toy gun at home or, you know, something like that. Like, you can create it from anything. So I love that idea. Like, parents know their kids best, so I love that. What are some challenges that you've encountered when applying NET goals and ABA, and how can practitioners overcome some of these challenges?
So as far as challenges go, I think one of the biggest challenges, of course, the needs of identifying the core needs of the client. And then in addition, of course, the training of the clinician, the technician, to run those goals, right? But I think, like I said before, earlier, let me think about this for a second. So what we need to do when we're working with our clients to understand the right goals or to address the right things and then be able to model for our technicians is to understand what they're doing and how to get on their level. And it starts with just extending those circles of communication with them. We need to pair with them and understand what currently their deficits are in not allowing them to do in their environment, with people, with their toys, right? And once we understand how we can connect with them and their environment, we can start to build out what the net-based goals look like in terms of their skill level. And for our clients who don't have verbal behavior, this is another thing that can be a barrier. They have very limited language or limited interests. I think that's where we actually need to lean into understanding their interests even more and extend the pairing phase, right? We need to be experts on what makes them light up, what gives them that gleam in their eye, right? Language and social interaction forms around the things that children care about most. And this is something I was talking about last night when I was talking about shaping early vocal verbal behavior. We need to start with words and things that matter to them, right? And so we need to treat all behavior that like it's purposeful and require that we're doing our part to make sure that we have a reciprocal relationship with them. And responding and initiating joint attention would be some of the first skills I would work on, and then you would want to go from and expand from there. There's a couple developmental models that I think about that aren't necessarily ABA based that kind of inform how I'm thinking about what to do these days in terms of what pivotal behaviors to focus on. And just a plug for a couple of them, floor time, which is also called DIR, is a popular developmental model that's used in OT settings, which for me is helping me understand the developmental milestones and capacities that children normally or typically develop over their lifespan. And it goes until adulthood. And then Jasper as well is also another naturalistic intervention-based model that looks at some of what we would probably call pivotal behaviors and has an intentional naturalistic model to teach some of those core skills through play. So I really would suggest that sometimes we become so narrow-minded in looking at our models and our curriculums, right? Like the ABLES, the VBMAP. Those models, I think, are inherently great, like I said before, in their structure and adherence to structure and designing a curriculum around skills. But it picks apart skills too much, and it doesn't look at holistic skills, like the ones that integrate into many other skills, the pivotal behaviors we've been talking about. And I think just thinking a little bit, it doesn't mean we need to get rid of all our goals, right? But just thinking about how we can address more core deficits, more prerequisite skills with our clients, will go a long way. We need to disseminate that to not only BCBAs, but also technicians. Think about the fundamentals, right? And teach them what the fundamentals are too.
Yeah. no, that's so important. And speaking of like other practitioners and other people in the field, how can BCBAs collaborate with other professionals, with speech and occupational therapists, to create more integrated approach for NET?
Yeah. Well, personally, in my experience, for what I've seen, OT does this best in terms of leading with naturalistic interventions. So I think personally, just this is my thing, I think talk to an OT and try to understand what kind of interventions they're using to engage with them and teach them basic foundational skills, but also more advanced social skills. They run a lot of awesome social skill groups and challenge them to think on a higher level. Definitely collaborate with OTs. is my first suggestion. They have a lot of awesome naturalistic interventions in their toolboxes. I haven't worked as much and haven't seen as much of that in speech. I think speech, although from an outside perspective, looks like it would be more similar to ABA, but I think my philosophy, at least, aligns better with the OT approach development, with the more consistent developmental model. Which doesn't mean we shouldn't collaborate with speech pathologists. I'm not saying that at all. I think they're extremely important providers. And they have a lot of knowledge to disseminate, especially when it comes to breaking down motor skills and understanding with the delays or what is causing some of the barriers that we're not able to break through behaviorally, even with motivational tactics or reinforcement strategies that are and prompting that are foundational to ABA, of course.
Yeah, I think that's great. And what I've kind of observed when I've seen clients, like for, you know, speech and OT, like we're all kind of working on the same goal. It just looks different. So for all of us, like we're all working, it's okay. We want them to communicate more. We want them, you know, like those fine motor skills, like for OT, like sometimes they're working on that. But like we're all in some way, shape or form, we're working on very similar things with ABA that the approaches just look different. So I think that's really great to reach out to OT because they do have a lot of play and social skills. So I think that's a great idea and that's great advice for ABA practitioners. How do you measure the effectiveness of NET or client-led activities?
So that's a great question. And I think this is one that probably a lot of people ask or think about when they're designing NET goals. And I think the best way to do it is to be explicit about what you want them to do. If it's about, I'm going to go back to the example of, I think we need to model, right? First, we need to model with the technician. And I think what can overwhelm clinicians, but also technicians, is that you're trying to throw too many things in at once and it seems confusing. And what I would suggest is starting with a NET goal that has one discrete goal that you're trying to run. So take my example of the imaginary play goal. Maybe what you're doing solely focusing on in that scenario is them answering specific WH questions within that imaginary play scheme. So you write it as answers WH questions in imaginary play scheme. And you model that, you get that mastered, the technician can do it, great. Then we can expand from there. Then we incorporate that, plus maybe some emotional thinking that happens, right? You're in outer space again, and the client is, I should say, maybe the technician starts to become cold or afraid that they're out there and they don't know what to do. And they maybe seek the support or help, emotional support of the client, right, in that moment. And so then you're starting to integrate emotions and problem solving into one play scheme. And you just kind of stack and scaffold from there until it becomes this really cool, functional, well-trained program that is working on a lot of different skills, but it's coming in a staggered fashion. So it's not overwhelming to teach, and for the technician, it's not overwhelming for them to comprehend and learn.
Yeah, I love that too, because I always think that measuring goals, like when I'm in writing those programs, is this going to, like, how is this going to be generalized and how am I going to measure these programs? But I think you explained that really well. So I think it could be the same program, but the setting can look totally different, right? So like maybe you're in space today, maybe you're, you know, on a pirate ship one day. So like, I love that you're using that in imaginative play for the clients that have that skill set. But also, I like that you also mentioned using like a toy, like, so there's different ways that you can incorporate that. So I think you've explained that really well.
Thank you. Yeah, like a shape sorter. It could be a circle that's yellow, but then the circle is also a sun. And then you're starting to engage in, you're broadening your perspective, and then all of a sudden the sun becomes hot, right? And you need water. And like, you shape, right? You don't start with imaginary play. That's an advanced skill, right, for a lot of our learners. But you start with the foundations. You broaden their perspective of, this is not just a circle. It's not just yellow. It's also a sun. And now all of a sudden the sun is doing things that we need to interact with and can be part of the basis of play. So you it's shaping.
Yeah. No, it's beautiful. It's a great way to introduce some of those skills. So I love it. How do you adapt natural teaching goals to meet the diverse needs of learners with varying abilities?
So I feel like I touched on this a little bit, but I think it again, it comes back to pairing. So assessments can provide a good foundation for us to know where to start, right, with our with their skills, right? It's really great at that. Certainly VBMAP is awesome for that. The ABLEs, all those assessments are great at understanding where they are developmentally. But I think we do get caught up in trying to check the boxes of the typically developing behaviors without addressing the core ones. And take a client who doesn't have a lot of language yet, is non-vocal, non-verbal, right? Again, we need to go back to the pairing phase and understand their world and how they engage with it and start to bring them out of that shell, right? Bring them into a shared world where we can learn and interact together. And so just lead your programming through the lens of pairing, especially with the clients who don't have language yet. I think we just get so focused on getting to the acquisition task that we forget that pairing is the acquisition in this stage, and perhaps forever, right? Like I was saying before, imaginary play, this is pairing, right? This is still pairing, but it's also programming and they don't even know it, you know? So I think, look at the developmental models, look at, again, Jasper and the floor time model are great ways to start to rethink how you think about what you want to work on. And yes, you need to, for insurance purposes, need to, of course, work on and develop these skill sets. But what you'll see is that as you work on these foundational skills, this is what's so amazing about pivotal behaviors, is that these behaviors that you're trying to master through discrete trial acquisition will naturally come about and flourish through working on these pivotal base behaviors, these foundational things that are addressing the core deficits of ASD, which is what we're all here for.
Yeah, no, that's great. So for training and supervision, what kind of training or supervision do you provide to the newbies phase or RBTs to implement some of these goals?
So I provide support and supervision on naturalistic instruction on a number of levels. I provide mentorship and training to my student supervisees who are in their master's programs, any first year BCBAs, QBAs, BCABAs, QASPs, and like I said before, I think what I try to do is not necessarily criticize their programming, but challenge their existing default approaches and to ask questions and try to understand what their current assumptions about their client is, you know, and have them think a little bit deeper about client-led interests and lead with that. I do a few other things. I disseminate CEUs. I have done a pivotal response training CEU, and I'm planning to actually create one that's about kind of what I'm talking about today. I'd be happy to. It talks about responsivity to multiple cues and just other good, great evidence-based procedures that we should be using in everyday programming. But yeah, I'm developing another one too right now that encapsulates a lot of what I'm talking about today, is how to design naturalistic interventions and address all the skills we need to address through core behaviors.
I think that's great too. And then the fact that you have these new providers, like, and you're molding them, so now you can teach them how to do these interventions and how to do, because I think too, when I first started, that wasn't the way that I was taught, right? So, and maybe their supervision or their training that's not the way that they were taught. So this is like a whole new concept, I think, for a lot of providers in our field. So I think you're really leading the way. Amazing. And then, you know, they're starting that way, so you can really shape some of their programming. So I love it.
Totally. I hear BCBAs and technicians screaming at the top of their lungs that they don't want their clients memorizing responses anymore. They don't know what they're getting out of them. I mean, I have students who are in this situation right now. And a thing from a caregiver perspective, too, parents have a difficult time seeing the purpose of what we're doing sometimes. Yeah. And they wonder why the caregivers, we wonder as clinicians why the caregivers are having trouble generalizing our programs. And so I think providers are looking at ABA models sometimes as a way to maximize profits and not always, and hours, and not necessarily to focus in on the things that are going to help our clients break out of their shell. Again, think about nuance, engage in imaginative play, develop strong emotional attachment with their caregivers and friends, you know? And I think there's been a couple of periods of in our history, like we started with DTT with Lovaas, and then PRT, which is not a new concept. It came out, I think, 30 years ago or longer. But I think we're having a second resurgence, and this call for naturalistic intervention is really, I hear it every day. And I'm just, I feel lucky to be in a place where I can be digging into this and helping disseminate some of these thoughts, which are not new.
Right. No, yeah. That's a great approach too. So I love that. And it's nice to be in a place where you can dig into that, because there are companies out there where it is very much like, we don't want anything new. I mean, it's not new, but we want to keep doing the same thing. This is the SD. This is the same answer. And now we're not generalizing any of these skills. So kind of, it is like, what is the point, right?
I know.
So what do you think or how do you see the role of natural teaching goals evolving in the field of ABA over the next few years?
I think that we're on the precipice of doing the same thing right now with naturalistic interventions. And I think it's important for people to challenge our current skills curriculums. I'm not afraid to say that I think our current models are prescribing DTT. I really do. I think that that is the way that it's taught. And I think our clinicians are also undertrained. They're not trained to think outside of that box because it's not as easy to train. It's sometimes it can be harder to measure. It takes a little bit more creativity. Early Start Denver model is one that people are familiar with and actually isn't originally an ABA assessment, right? But it is completely play-based, completely net-based. And there's a new skills curriculum, actually, that just came out called MODOS. I don't know if you know about that or are familiar with it. But the MODOS skills curriculum is trying to be better about recognizing the importance of directing skills towards addressing ASD deficits and not just checking off skills that are based off of a pediatrician's developmental milestones of typical behaviors that occur, you know, really relating back to what's functional for a person, what's going to generalize and things like that. So the MODOS is coming, and I think that might help. But it's not going to be, I don't think it's going to be completely game-changing. I think we need more models like the Early Start Denver model specifically that just work for other age groups.
And I know you touched on this a little bit, but are there any specific resources or articles or training? You mentioned a couple of programs that you would recommend to practitioners to help learn more about natural teaching.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you want to step outside of like the ABA world, the first place I would recommend, this book I would recommend is something called Engaging Autism. It's a book called Engaging Autism by Dr. Greenspan. And it heavily leans on the purpose and usefulness of play, attachment with others, and the function of emotions as a core focus for addressing the deficits of ASD. This has, a more developmental focused model. Another recommendation I would have is the Jasper model for children with autism. That's a book that's on Amazon by Dr. Kasari out of UCAL. And this has a more hybrid teaching model that is both developmental. So it has a stronger emphasis, though, on supporting regulation, symbolic play, and naturalistic teaching. But it does that by combining it with behavioral strategies that we're familiar with, like modeling, prompting, and fading procedures. As far as like literature goes, my one recommendation I have is to look at an article called Shreveman et al. I think her first name is Laura Shreveman, 2015. And that's a meta-analysis of naturalistic interventions that are behavioral in nature and have empirical support for use with ASD. It discusses things like the ESDM. It goes into something called enhanced MILU or MILU teaching, EMT, a reciprocal imitation training, RIT, Jasper, which I mentioned the book for, and then something called SKIRTS. So it has a few plugs there that are developmental in nature, naturalistic, but also have a behavioral foundation.
So I know we've talked about like how you're teaching the new BCBAs, but what advice would you have for any new BCBA that's just starting to incorporate client-led activities into their practice?
Yeah, I think my first word of advice is to spend more time thinking critically about leveraging pairing to teach. We spend a great deal of time understanding our clients' reinforcers to maximize pairing and client buy-in, right? I think it's important to take the time to ask yourself, how can I make 5 to 10 of these targets from the VDMAP or ABLES, how can we make those targets revolve around the reinforcers? That's the first thing I'd recommend. The second thing I would do is highlight and urge everyone to spend a greater amount of time and proportion of our time focusing on the play targets, the social and play targets, which are on the VDMAP, but underutilized. I think that these specific skills serve as the bedrock for individuals as they learn how to connect with the world and the people in it. I think personally speaking from my own experience, I've seen a lot of communication targets skyrocket, but then seeing the social and the play targets just kind of meagerly, budging along. And I don't think this is, unique to me. And I think it's because of how much emphasis we place on discrete skeletal acquisition. And we leave some of the more intangible goals like spontaneous behavior, creativity, to develop on their own, right? And as I said before, I think ASD is typified by an inability to think in the gray, to understand nuance. And there's a whole lot of that gray area in the human world we live in, you know? So just think about the benefit, the qualitative and, meaningful benefit of doing that and lead with that.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Chris, I just want to tell you, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on today. On our episode, and this is so informative, and it's definitely something I want to do more in my practice. Like I mentioned before, this isn't the way that I was taught to do it. I was just taught to almost robotically, right? Yeah. Just run programs, right? The same SDs, the same responses. We're not really generalizing skills. So this is definitely an area that I want to expand on more. And I think there's a lot of practitioners out there that would like to do the same as well. Thank you so much, Chris, for joining me today. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Thank you. Until next time.